Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the double pleasure of speaking with Dr. Gil Ben-Harut from the University of South Florida, and also Dr. John Coyne from Michigan State University. They are both co-editors of a fascinating volume that's part of the Routledge South Asian Religion series. It's called Regional Communities of Devotion in South Asia, Insiders, Outsiders, and Interlopers. The volume was edited by both Gil and John, and also Anne Monius, who we will mention shortly. Welcome to the podcast, gentlemen.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
It's a pleasure.
So, I study Purana. There's a backstory to everything. So what is the backstory of how did this volume come into being?
Well, a little bit of extra backstory is that this volume comes out of a collaboration, out of an academic group that Gil and I co-founded back in 2013 called the Regional Bhakti Scholars Network. And we did this because we were introduced by Jack Hawley, actually, at a conference and realized that we shared some interests in bhakti in common. And in the course of talking about things, we discovered that we both had information about our respective traditions in Maharashtra and Karnataka that we were interested in, but we couldn't have otherwise known if we hadn't have accidentally fallen into that conversation. And so we thought, well, why don't we try to make this a little more programmatic, bring people together systematically and encourage these conversations, and thus the RBSN, the Regional Bhakti Scholars Network, was born. So the group tries to encourage people to have conversations across their specializations of region and language, to explore connections that bhakti traditions have, to look at bhakti from a lot of different angles. We intentionally did not try to define bhakti from the outset. We're basically just getting people together to try to explore and collaborate on research on bhakti. So that's where the RBSN came from. And probably hand it over to Gil. He has a more stay.
Kind of, if we're in this Puranic narration mode, we're moving into an inner frame of the story, where John and I started to organize these annual, well, it was necessary to find some kind of a site for getting scholars together for a conversation. And that happened in different places, but annually in the Madison conference, the annual conference on South Asia. And the first symposium we had there was dedicated to John or Jack Hawley's book about the Bhakti movement, A Storm of Songs, where we were very excited to think together with different scholars of bhakti in the room about moving beyond this notion of bhakti as one thing and trying to explore bhakti from region to region. From that symposium in 2014 came out a dedicated volume in the Journal of Hindu Studies with contributions by John Coyne, Anne Monius, myself, and Jack as a respondent. And when we saw that, we kind of took that to the next level in the following year in 2015 with a symposium that was titled Who's In, Who's Out, right? When basically we got more scholars actually than what ended up in the book to discuss these kind of different configurations of bhakti against others. And when we finished that symposium, the Rutledge editor contacted us and asked us, you know, if we would consider kind of publishing proceedings from that symposium. So that was our cue to consider this.
And when they did that, we had a few reservations actually at first, because both of us were assistant professors at the time, and were not sure about taking on a co-edited volume. And that's where especially Anne Monius's leadership kicked in. She's been integral to the RBSN from the beginning, but she basically said that she would take on the leadership of marshaling a co-edited volume through a publication process, and said that she would shoulder most of the burden with some of that heavier lifting, so that, you know, we could both pursue our respective tenure cases. So Anne was integral into having this volume come out at all. And not only the volume, but she was there from the very first meeting in 2013. As we established the RBSN, she helped guide us with ideas. And very crucially, when we were thinking about how to start out some initial programming, she, out of the blue, offered to host a two-day workshop at Harvard with some of the ideas that we were talking about. And this was absolutely crucial for starting the entire RBSN.
Yeah. So for us, kind of two young scholars with some ideas about getting people together to meet an established professor as Anne Monius and having her auspices of the first physical event was just, it had an amazing effect. It gives us this oomph, right? One of those words that Anne used to say and own. But like John said, I think in a deeper sense, Anne served as a mentor for us in the RBSN. We got into this kind of rhythm of meeting Anne regularly in conferences and bringing our ideas to her. And she would always pick them up and develop and kind of put them in the right perspective. In terms of really, I mean, I think Anne has this, had these two elements in her, one incredibly smiling and accepting personality on the one hand, and this very uncompromising critical mind. And both of these elements, I think, were kind of shaped the way RBSN moved forward. So she was an incredible, incredible help. And of course, together with Jack Hawley, whose assistance is just too valuable even to start kind of unpacking, but it was huge. But to go back to this tribute that we're making for Anne now, is that just to kind of acknowledge the importance of her intellectual leadership, you know, and whenever we had an idea, it was through her prisms of what do you want to get out of this and how are you going to approach the community of scholars with these ideas. Beyond that, Anne had incredible scholarly influence on our writings. And I think it's a tragedy that she passed away prematurely before more of her work got published, because her critical lenses and voice were both essential and I think very, very unique. And that's it. That's what we have today of her.
Yeah, the RBSN wouldn't be what it became without Anne's help and encouragement. She's been absolutely vital, not only to the volume, but to the entire academic community that we're in.
Well, it bespeaks the real force as a scholar and also clearly as an administrator and as a guide that she was, and also even in the academic secular context, you know, the power of parampara, the primacy of the guru, the need to have that guidance and to have that clout and to have on some level the validation and the vetting of ideas. And as it appears, stories within stories is the theme of the day, and there will be no complaint from this incarnate bard, but nevertheless, Anne Monius was the advisor of my own doctoral advisor, Beth Rollman. She's now at Calgary. She started off with Anne when Anne was at UVA before she got the Harvard job, and she continued to support Beth to completion of her degree. And so, interestingly enough, this force at the Academy has touched many lives directly and indirectly, indeed. Another thing that comes to mind is that currently at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, I have been entrusted with the task of convening these events called online weekend schools. They're sort of the love child of a symposium and a class, a learning environment where continuing studies people can come and learn. And we had a very rich group of scholars speak on the last one on Hindu goddess, the one before on yoga studies. The next one will be on the Mahabharata, but I was actually thinking just yesterday that bhakti would be a great topic for one of these events. So we'll follow up and see if we can't round up some of your colleagues to present at the OCHS on bhakti. But enough subtitles for one day. Let's get back to the main story. Tell us what's in this book. Like what papers comprise this regional communities of devotion in South Asia?
Right. So we have to be careful of this Puranic digression, right? This digression. The edited volume, as it came out, contains 9 essays. It has an introduction, which, again, with the leadership of Anne, I think lays out very effectively what we set out to explore in this book by bringing together all these scholars. We can briefly mention, you know, chapter by chapter, the contributors, and just one or two sentences about what's inside the chapter. The first 4 chapters are involved the southern devotional traditions of Tamil, Kannada, and Malayalam, and the next 5 kind of move up north. There is a reflection here about the famous and infamous bhakti movement from south to north. But I think we addressed that issue of making it explicit. In other words, the order of the chapters already conveys with it some kind of inherited practices of the tradition that we also want to question. I'm just putting it out there. But let me begin. So the first chapter by Anne Monius is titled From Foolish Ascetics to Enemies of Shiva, The Fate of Jains as Religious Others in Tamil Shaiva Literature. In this chapter, she reads the corpus of the 7th century Tamil Shaiva poet Appar against the grain of contemporary scholarship. She shows how Tamil Shaiva uses of Jain imagery change quite dramatically over time, even in the reception history of a single Tamil Shaiva poet. She also argues that a flat documentary reading of the poet's eye in the poems as a former Jain masks the complexity of the role that Jains actually play in early Shaiva literature. The second chapter by Elaine Craddock is titled Kali Dances into the Cremation Grounds of the Tamil Land. And it posits local goddesses as the primary others of early Tamil Shaivism. There she examines the gradual displacement and appropriation of local goddess traditions as Shiva comes to dominate the religious landscape. And this process intensifies as the myth, iconography, and temple worship practices of the god Shiva become the uniting force of a newly defined community in a competitive religious milieu. The third chapter is my own, and it's titled Arguing with Vaishnavas, Annihilating Jains, Two Religious Others in Early Kannada Shiva Bhakti Hagiographies. In this chapter, I consider distinct typologies of alterity in early Kannada language Shaiva narrative. So I employ the categories of opponent other and holy other to distinguish between Brahmins and Jains in the Shaiva's rhetoric of alienation. And I also show how the proclaimed differences between the self and the other are in fact suggestive of particularly vulnerable areas in the identity of the collective communal self. The fourth chapter by Rich Freeman is titled Bhakti Inc. Kerala, Alienated Selves and Assimilated Others. And this chapter focuses on the assimilative qualities of Kerala's bhakti traditions. And it argues that bhakti enables social assimilation through its rhetoric and its system of rituals in varied relations, ranging from adulation to alliance to servitude.
The last five chapters are all about Western and Northern India. And as Gil said, we had actually talked when we were setting up this book about how to order the chapters. And we played with the idea of ordering them in some different ways, which would have brought out maybe some other kinds of relationships that just the South versus the North wouldn't have done. But obviously, you have to commit to one table of contents and move on. So the fifth chapter is my own, entitled The Challenge of the Swappable Other, a Framework for Interpreting Otherness in Bhakti Texts. And I talk about three aspects of representing otherness. So that when Bhakti advocates are talking about others, we ought to be sensitive to three different things. One is the ontology of otherness, the specific names and concepts that people have for their others. A second thing is the grammar or a worldview of otherness, in which otherness is evaluated and positions the person who's talking or the tradition who is representing others, positions them to have certain kinds of relationships rather than others. And the third aspect is modes of representation, or the goals or agendas in representing otherness, which shapes the ways that the others appear. And I offer that as three aspects for thinking about what we should do or what we should look for whenever we see representations of otherness, because all of this affects our understanding. The sixth chapter is by Christian Lee Novetsky. It's entitled The Political Field of Bhakti at the Emergence of Marathi Literature in Pre-Modern India. And he argues that bhakti is very political. And so as bhakti advocates talk about others, they're effectively including and excluding members from the communities, all while sharing in language that's explicitly political at the time, is being used by political actors. And he shows this with two quite different examples from the 13th century. Nyandev of the Warkari tradition, who is relatively amenable to his local rulers, and Chakradar, a foundational figure for the Mahanubhav tradition, who positions himself much more strongly in opposition to the leaders. The seventh chapter is by Jeremy Morse. This is the Dutta Sampradaya and its others. He looks at guru bhakti. So bhakti, especially towards one's guru, in a smaller, lesser known Maharashtrian group, the Dutta Sampradaya, which, and in his article, his chapter, he's focusing on Muslims as others, which are very often talked about in the Dutta Sampradaya. But he points out that deeper underneath, in a lot of their literature, there's clearly more anxiety, not so much about the Muslims, but about what it means to be Brahmin, especially what it means to be Brahmin at a time when so many Brahmins were working as administrators for the Deccan Sultanates. The eighth chapter is by Philip Lutgendorf, entitled Lost in the Lake, Tulsidas and His Others. And Philip argues that Tulsidas in the Ramcharitmanas implicitly, but also consistently, is an otherizing saints and advocates who are very much within bhakti traditions, except with a different vision of who, what God looks like, especially God without qualities. And he highlights that although this is still bhakti and very much within accepted bhakti traditions, there are still internal arguments that are going on. And the final essay is by Anand Venkat Krishnan, who examines how some Mimamsaka philosophers, who usually aren't known for being very amenable to bhakti or thinking directly about God very much, nonetheless adapted themselves and some devotional themes to their own self-understanding and their own rewriting of history. And so he argues that at least for some Mimamsaka branches, the branches go out a little bit further and encompass more than is usually commonly thought. And bhakti actually plays a role in this, even implicitly. So that's the entirety of the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, there's a number of fascinating papers there. Let's pan out a little bit, perhaps, and talk about the volume as a whole. What would you say? Does it argue something overall? Is it just a collection of fascinating arguments? Where does it fit in the field? You know, what does it contribute? Would you say?
Well, I think we can address this question maybe through the kind of the coming of being of this book, not as we described before, but from an intellectual point of view, what we were aiming at, right? What we wanted to achieve. And I think the starting point was this maybe a sort of a naive or initial rudimentary excitement from this idea of othering in relation to bhakti, right? Because we're in academy today, and I think more broadly, everyone is very sensitive and cognizant of this issue of othering and its kind of effect or result in communalism and even sectarianism and sectarian violence. But these are, first of all, they're rarely addressed in the study of bhakti. And so there was a kind of a, not a lacuna, but sort of a kind of an uncharted field. What happens when we look using these lenses at the kind of the familiar, more kind of, I don't know how to call this familiar field of bhakti studies, but to approach it in a fresh lens of othering. And beyond that, I think, and this is a different point of view, the idea of othering is already with us when we look back at the past. And we wanted also to examine that. How do we examine this idea of religious difference or religious inclusiveness? How do we see that unfold when we look in materials that we call, or the traditions themselves call, bhakti? So there was this kind of, you know, I think an initial impulse of curiosity that pushed us into it. And very quickly we noticed that, in fact, when we examine these materials that define the other or talk about the other, they are very much interested in defining themselves, right? So you're immediately kind of thrown into this dyad, into this binary, where there is an other, but what we are, but we are, in other words, right? One, while we talk about the other, we are defining who we are as a community, as a religion, as an idea, as a self. And we also notice that this rhetoric of othering takes very different shapes from one region to another, and it's very much contingent upon historical contexts. And in that sense, it served well, I think, the role of RBSN to kind of enrich and diverse and complicate the idea of what bhakti is, and moving into a notion of bhaktis in the plural. So the moment I think we understood that this can be a major hinge or a vector for exploring bhakti more generally, we decided to develop it, I think, further in the book.
Another thing that it pointed out, and I think this is one of the values of the book, is that in exploring all of the diverse renderings of others, and including a vast array of different kinds of others across the South Asia, what I think the book also shows is that there is a certain integrity to bhakti as an organizing concept. And that, for some people, there have been some criticisms of that, that bhakti has been overly reified, it's been invested with too much importance, or too many things that bhakti supposedly did as a force in South Asian history. And even within the larger RBSN, these warnings they're very well taken. But I think the volume points out that there is something of a reality to bhakti as a discrete category, both in the traditions that are using this term explicitly and in ways of sort of Eddic usage that we've employed to group them together by common discursive tactics that they employ. And I think the essays demonstrate this very well, both in terms of the groups that they're talking about, the traditions and individuals that we're drawing on this discourse. So in highlighting the differences among all of the bhakti traditions and authors, as these essays do, they not only point out traditions that we're very familiar with, such as that Gil and I work on with the Varkaris and the Virashaivas, but many of the essays also help us push beyond the conventional boundaries of what a bhakti tradition, what we usually think of in terms of bhakti traditions. So especially thinking of Jeremy Morse's and Rich Freeman's and Anand Venkatakrishnan's essays, looking at the Mimamsakas, or bhakti in Kerala, which has a much more kind of amorphous figure, amorphous kind of character, and bhakti devoted to the guru. So we wanted to be inclusive in this volume. And in doing so, I think, although we didn't come back to the conventional view of bhakti just as a single bhakti tradition or the bhakti movement as a singular entity, we did, I think, still come back to reaffirming the validity of bhakti as an analytical category.
There is coincidentally, right before this podcast, so these podcasts began as a favor, then became a hobby, and they're now sort of a lifestyle. You kind of put them in between client calls and scholarship, and I'm sure you're all well aware of the need to juggle in these times. But right before, immediately before this class, this podcast, that was a Freudian slip, I had a class, I was teaching a class called the Textual Tapestry, Threads of Indian Tradition. So it's essentially an introduction. It's an introduction to Hinduism, essentially. And so we artificially look at the different strands, anachronistically, but chronologically, the Vedic strand, the Upanishadic strand, the epics, the devotion strand, the Tantra strand. Those are the five that we focus on. And then in the last class, which happened to be today, we show that in modern Hinduism, it's a tapestry. But the face of that tapestry is the idiom of bhakti. All of the images we looked at, whether we see Vedic fire sacrifice at the temple, regardless of which strand of religiosity, bhakti is the idiom. I call it the Hindu jungle. The face of the jungle is bhakti, and we can't. There's no getting around that. So, in my personal view, it's not really possible to give bhakti too much press time when studying the Hindu jungle, but that's my opinion. So what you're saying resonates.
You're not going to get an argument from us against that.
I realize.
I think it's a great point to highlight on the difficulty of studying bhakti, right? And this highlighting of bhakti as a category, exactly because it's all over and it's claimed by everyone. The sort of an elephant in the room is the modern, contemporary nationalistic use of bhakt, right? This which is very different than what we're talking about when we're talking about pre-modernity. And there are, but this is just one example of how bhakti is can mean different things for different people in different contexts. And I would, I think for me, there is something about the Anthropocene, this kind of the human at the center of bhakti, this human sensibilities, which are become so important, so highlighted in bhakti that makes it amenable for different uses. But it's important to say we're not, and it was clear to me, to John and I from the beginning, we actually make an active effort not to define bhakti in any kind of conclusive way. I think they're doing something very practical about this active avoidance, because once we'll do that, we know that we will exclude, by definition, other materials that might be relevant and shed light. I mean, you know, the Hindu fold outside the Hindu fold, right? You mentioned just now how bhakti is kind of everywhere. So this kind of cultural hue of bhakti versus bhakti as these very well-defined closed communities. All kind of different axes that we can define where bhakti refuses to fit or behave well by sticking to one of the ends of these dyads. So I think for us, it was important to allow these conversations and these challenges of the idea of bhakti. And I think secondly, we hope that by this activity, we show that it is useful. Even though it's difficult to define, it is very creative and useful to work with bhakti and not to just say, oh, well, you know, everything is bhakti. We shouldn't work with that as a category. On the contrary, working with this problematic category can be very creative.
So do you want to, please go ahead, John.
Yeah, so I'm also piggybacking on that. The decision to hold the definition of bhakti open was not only an intellectual decision, so that would keep our minds open to sense out different connections that wouldn't have immediately occurred to us, but in the context of the RBSN, since we've been trying to be inclusive and expansive and encourage participation from a wide variety of people, we were encouraging people to be thinking creatively, and we still are encouraging that. And in our annual symposia at the Madison South Asia Conference, we have been for some years inviting other people to take up the reins, propose new themes, invite different kinds of people. And that's been very explicit and very intentional for us, that we wanted to be sort of a gathering place around the topic of bhakti. But by holding the definition open, we allowed more people to come up with their own definitions that even Gil and I wouldn't anticipate.
Well, it's part of why I find compelling this metaphor of the jungle, in that anything we can call Hinduism is an ecosystem, not a genus, not a species. And you know, one can study soil in the jungle, and it pervades so much of the jungle. One can study sap. One can study flight patterns, and like any category, any aperture into Indian religions, it necessarily becomes, you know, like a vine, like a creeper, so far-reaching that it interconnects in ways that we wouldn't anticipate at the outset as scholars. So it's fascinating. I'd love for you to maybe tell us a little bit more about the future of the network, or perhaps further developments on this work, or what you're working on now.
So in the near future, we have at the upcoming Madison South Asia Conference, another symposium. This topic is print and bhakti. So especially in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, the impact of printed works on changing the character, or of making materials available, or in some cases, even somewhat creating a canon by having an actual printed work there. We're looking at the effects of that. And that's another thing that cuts across South Asia, since printing presses did move across many different regions and languages. And so we thought that this would be another fruitful way to explore the possibilities of understanding bhakti, but with a different sort of common thread running through them. So that's coming up here in October. But this is just the most recent iteration of this annual format that we have kind of gotten into. And every year we have a different topic. This past year at Madison, because of the pandemic, we held off for a year rather than try to meet then. But we intentionally choose very diverse topics. And Gil and I introduced the first few of them, and then we explicitly made a decision. We wanted to invite other people to introduce themes and take up the reins. So that's going to continue on. And in the future, as we've done this, and especially as we've had more experience now online here this past year with the pandemic, we are considering and exploring some other kinds of online platforms that might facilitate, like what you were saying, Raj, of these weekend classes, facilitate something that's a little bit less heavy on the planning side, that maybe is more flexible and could serve like the purposes of some smaller groups, like say just, you know, short workshops or something that are virtual kind of hybrid style. So we're sort of thinking about what this might look like. We haven't made decisions yet, but it seems appealing.
Yes, and I can pick up this thread of online and maybe talk about a little bit about Bhava, the current project that we're working on, which is technological in essence, right? The Bhava is the acronym for Bhakti Virtual Archive. It's a project that has been in development for the last 5 years. We got the funding of the American Library Association, and recently the very generous and important support of the American Institute of Indian Studies for this as a digital humanities scholarship. The Bhakti Virtual Archive was born out of this recognition that we need, it's time again to organize all the bibliographies about Bhakti, something that if you look back, happened once or twice before in recent decades. There is something that plagues the scholarship of Bhakti in relation to understanding what Bhakti is, and that is that the scholarship is scattered. It appears many times in edited volumes that are hard to find, uncatalogued, and just not marked in an easy manner. So we thought, well, if it's time to create this bibliography of the field of Bhakti, maybe we should consider doing it with the digital technology rather than the traditional publication. And that idea started to roll and develop into this engine, search engine, where people could go into the website, which will be open to the public, and search for Bhakti scholarship, but through different lenses and through different categories. If you're interested in knowing about, female Bhakti poetesses from the pre-modern, or if you want to know about commensality and food practices in Bhakti of a certain century, you could get all the scholarship about these themes across regions, across languages, in ways that are really hard to find today when people approach Bhakti, the field of Bhakti, and want to learn more about. I think this is essential both for research and teaching. And these ideas that we started to roll out are now taking form. I want to invite everyone to our website, regionalbhakti.org, where you'll find information about the RBSN activities in different perspectives and dimensions, but also there is a section about Bhava and its ongoing process. We are very excited right now. We're doing the curation that involves 13 different scholars, experts of regional Bhakti traditions, and we're collating all that information into one big database of scholarship about Bhakti, both primary and secondary materials. We estimate, we hope to reach something of about 5,000 items in that engine with a very nice and sophisticated but easy to use search engine performing these searches. I think something to connect to that is that the Bhava will facilitate ongoing research about Bhakti across regions. That its core goal. And John and I are thinking about the following symposium to be dedicated to exactly that. How when we get all these scholarship kind of re-examined or represented through these digital technologies, when we can find different scholarships, what do we find? Can we make that into an intellectual pursuit of shared themes or differences between different Bhakti traditions, between periods, between historical contexts? So we want our future symposium or symposia to be dedicated to that. And that is just one example of the sort of collaborations that I think get John and I going in the RBSN.
That is fascinating. It's really rich. It's super important in our times to have digital tools, and it sounds like you're engaged in some really important, exciting work. We'll be sure to include the URL in the podcast notes as well of whatever you'd like folks to follow up on. John, was there something you wanted to say?
Unless you wanted us to talk about our own individual future research, we could do that.
Yeah, but, sure. I often.
So I've got a book coming out later this month here. This is Shared Devotion, Shared Foods, Equality and the Bhakti Caste Question in Western India. That looks at the saints that I've been focusing on, Eknath of Paithan, and his stories of interacting, especially with Dalits, and the question of equality, after, especially framed by Dr. Ambedkar. That's coming out. I'm working on some translations of Eknath's Bharuds. These are allegorical drama poems in which Eknath takes on the persona of a number of different socially marginal characters. He also writes in terms of Persian administrative letters. But what's most fascinating to me is he takes on the persona of Dalit characters and teaches spiritual messages through them. So I'm working on some translations of that. I've got a project looking at transnational Buddhism between Ambedkarite Buddhists in India with Buddhists in Taiwan and Japan. And I'm gradually making something of a turn towards transnational religion and doing some comparative studies of Indian and Chinese traditions.
Now, rumor has it that you'll be back on this podcast, isn't it?
That's what I've heard.
I've heard the same, so that's a good sign. Gil, what are you working on now?
Well, again, in connection to John, right, I'm working right now on a translation project. Actually, it's a co-translation with my Kannada teacher, Professor RVS Sundaram. And it's conceived as a kind of a follow-up to my first book. My first book, Shiva's Saints, discusses, and it's an argumentative monograph about this collection of stories from the 13th century about the Shaiva Bhakti saints. In this co-translation, we are actually translating and editing those stories for a separate publication. I have a tentative title in my head, Stories of Shiva's Saints, right? If the first book is Shiva's Saints, so this come up as a completion to really allow other people to read those fantastic stories, which I'm really excited. So I'm kind of steeped up to my ears with translation and editing and this sort of very different kind of academic faculty, you know, in our mind of that's called translation. I think that takes up a lot of my time. In addition to this, I'm also in a kind of a private right now digital humanities project of online dictionaries through a program, a software I wrote called Digital Roses. Check out digitalroses.net. And right now there are some Kannada dictionaries there and Prakrit and Sanskrit and English. And I'm doing all kinds of stuff with this idea of making more and more dictionaries, especially of less studied languages that are not available online, that are not as academically rich online, to make available those good old, you know, missionary dictionaries available online through scans and quick searches. So that is a digital humanities project that I kind of dabble with. In addition to this, I have a second book project on the Vachanas, this Bhakti poetry, which is so, you know, I think it has such an appeal as a universalist poetry, as A.K. Ramanujan famously presented in Speaking of Shiva. And I'm interested in the history of Vachanas. It tended to be called a history of speaking, tracing how Vachana literature was related to and perceived through the centuries. So these are, you know, different kind of projects, but it's all good, right? It's all generative and inspiring. So it's fine.
So it sounds like you along with John have tons of free time on your hands. you know, I have a number of guests on here of various stripes, all scholars, or at least their credentials and publications say so. But it seems that independent of this podcast, that all of us are at the forefront, the cutting edge of digital humanities and creating. We were ahead of the curve that COVID has sent the world scrambling towards, it seems. So, while I have you on this podcast, I would love to hear your thoughts about that. Make it a bit of context. I had this sort of, I'm in this very bizarre but fulfilling space of essentially being a self-employed academic, producing scholarship, teaching online, teaching and coaching as primary means of supporting myself, and online teaching used to be an embarrassing side gig in 2016, 2017. And as of 2020, colleagues and friends, established profs are like, hey, Raj, that kind of side gig of yours, how the hell do you do that? So the world's changing, obviously. And it seems from what I gather that you're also ahead of that curve or helping to shape it in no small measure in our field. And so what is your sense? I mean, I have no specific agenda in asking this. What is your sense of what's happening with digital humanities, with online education, with the fate of the academy, with learners? Like, it's a rich topic. If you can share some of your thoughts, that'd be fantastic.
That is a vast question. I'm not sure if I'm able to even speculate very well on sort of where the larger field is going, but just speaking personally about something that's kind of interesting to me and that's relevant to like my own teaching. So teaching at a place like Michigan State, large public university, students, you know, it's pretty accessible financially for a large number of students. So a lot of students come into my courses, especially about Asian religions, and have not traveled very widely. And it strikes me that digital humanities and multimedia productions help to integrate something into the classroom that is otherwise, I've honestly have sometimes struggled to bring across. You know, being in a different place, being situated in a different place, surrounded by, you know, different climate, different national rules and whatnot, is so important, I think, for understanding culture and religion. It's sometimes hard to bring that across in like an American classroom. And so like one thing that I've been trying to think about, especially with climate change, with, you know, the ecological weight of flights to different parts of the world and things, just thinking about how technology can be used to bring more sort of international presence into the classroom without requiring students to have to go places, because, you know, many students don't have the resources to do that. So, you know, I've been gradually working towards what I'm calling modules of international presence, and, you know, trying to have, just say, a little 15-minute, you see these on like YouTube, like little 15-minute clips of some sort of interesting presentation of an aspect of a tradition people haven't heard of, or, you know, there's like Religion for Breakfast is one of these YouTube channels that does this. So I've been thinking about trying to, you know, produce something fairly low key of my own with some of my contacts in places like India and Taiwan and Japan, and try to supplement classes with that, because not only does it address this sort of equity issue of students not being able to travel, or the ecological issue of the impact of travel, but also it's speaking to students with very much where they're at. You know, having them read, you know, one or two chapters of a textbook, you know, some students will get on board with that. But having them watch a YouTube video, you kind of can be confident everybody's going to have done that work. So I'm thinking just pedagogically, it's that side of it is essential.
Fantastic. Gil, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the topic is vast. We can address it in different ways. I think the technology is great where it brings something new to the table, right? So I think in the manner that John described very much, I think in the way that Bhakti Virtual Archive, Bhava, facilitates new kind of access to bibliographies, it's essential that the field of South Asia will catch up on digital literacy and digital accessibility of materials. And here I'm talking beyond the classroom, also about research, the availability of text and textual analysis in the realm of digital humanities. I mean, South Asia is so way behind China, the China's sinology, and of course Europe, and there is so much more work to be done there. On the flip side, you know, I still enjoy the smell of books, and I still, you know, I make the argument in my classroom that a printed book is the most sophisticated technology of consuming text. In other words, you can interact with it, you can scribble, you can find things very fast in its own way, maybe in completion to read digitally. In other words, I'm trying to find some kind of a balance, right? So on the one hand, really enriching digital environments and enjoying what they offer us on so many realms, like John said, the topic of equity in its manifold ways. And on the other hand, not to let go of, the tangible aspects and the value of personal relations. I mean, personal communication in conferences that happens outside the lecture hall, right? Outside the Zoom meeting, right? Those casual conferences is where RBSN was born. If we didn't have that, we would have no RBSN. So we have to be very kind of flexible, I think, and creative in the ways that we integrate and involve both modes of existence, the physical and the virtual.
And this technological side too, especially since we've been having conferences now here online for a year, there's lots of different ways of running a conference. So it doesn't have to be just a Zoom marathon session. There's sort of hybrid and flipped ways of interacting. And because now so many of us have been involved in this, especially for people who are moving across great distances and for whom, like, say, an annual meeting in the US in November, you know, for people to fly in from around the world to that, it's costly, it's not very practical, a lot of people don't have the means. I mean, this seems to be right on the cusp of creating some new venues that would be online and interactive to enable the international research and collaboration and things like conferences that don't necessarily have to take, you know, the long Zoom session format. The technology is all there, and it's not that hard to use. And in fact, you know, using sort of simpler technology for this, I think it's already starting to facilitate more international scholarship and international interaction.
Fascinating. When I started podcasting on this channel in 2018, part of my email, I just sent an email out to scholars who had recently published books to ask them if they wanted to appear. And one paragraph of that email was, I use this platform called Zoom. Where, you know, now there's no need to introduce Zoom. there's no need. Just one thing I want to touch on before we close, we're pretty much at time for today, is the importance of hybrid that both of you are echoing. Because the sweet spot to me really does seem to be the tasteful and the sensible integration of tradition and innovation. You know, to prioritize one over the other is perilous. And there's nothing that can replace the immersive experience of flying to Dubrovnik and experiencing Dubrovnik for the conference on the Sanskrit epics and Puranas. I haven't had that pleasure, but I've had the ability to present online last year. I think it's a triennial or biennial conference. And so there needs to be a way to, as I say, integrate tradition and innovation. Enough yammering on from me for today. Thank you both for appearing on the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this work, Raj, and for having us here on your podcast.
You're very welcome. For those of you listening, we've been talking to Dr. Gil Ben-Harut of University of South Florida and Dr. John Coyne of Michigan State University. They, along with the dearly departed Dr. And Monius of Harvard University, are co-editors of a brand new Routledge South Asian Religion Series publication called Regional Communities of Devotion in South Asia, Insiders, Outsiders, and Interlopers. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating bhakti. Take care.